Hi, my name is Doug Rowell. I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I just started my timer. I meant to start my timer, but I actually started my... Oh, great. John, how did you break this from all the way over there? There's a hole in it? This is the way I like to start my talk. It's, there you go. First of all, my name's Doug Rowell. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Grateful to be an alcoholic. Grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new and that sounds stupid, great. You're just like me. Because the first time I heard somebody say I'm a grateful alcoholic, I stood in the back of the room and said, and a moron. You're an idiot also, sir. I accept. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, I'm an alcoholic. I got this thing. I'm allergic to alcohol. The rest of my life, I can never successfully take another drink of alcohol. Woo, woo, I'm home. You know, my life today is so beautiful that my life today is better because I'm an alcoholic than it would have been if I had not been an alcoholic. And the people who have been around here a while, this head's nodding in here because you understand that. Yeah. When Jack said that he heard me in 1971 in Pittsburgh, I was there and I had a job. I'll tell you about it later. But I played one of the lead roles in a show called Hair, first national tour of a Broadway show called Hair, which was about hippies, and it was a good job. And I'll get into the details of what a good job it actually was later on. But what Jack didn't tell you was that he saw me naked. along with thousands of other people who also saw me naked, and I kind of feel a little guilty these days because I don't appear ever naked today, and and it's kind of a shame because there's so much more of me to see these days. I love doing this. I want to thank Kathy for inviting me, and Kathy and John for picking me up and bringing me out here from the hotel and making all the arrangements. And you know, it's funny. When I got sober, I thought the fun was over. Kathy and I were talking about that today. and there was a part of me that thought, you know, I may have used up my fun quotient because. I am not someone you will ever, ever hear say, I wouldn't trade my best day drinking for my worst day sober. Oh, I trade them in a second. You know, I mean, if they don't come that way, they come the way they're dealt out. But overall, of course, my life, as I said, sober is just a beautiful thing. I'm so grateful for it. But I had some fun drinking and using. By the way, let me get this out of the way. I'm also a drug addict. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a drug program. Some people try to, you know, make it like, oh, it's all the same thing. It's not all the same thing. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program designed specifically, I believe, from the mind of God to the hand of Bill Wilson to treat the disease of alcoholism. But if you happen to be like me, who is an alcoholic and a drug addict, and you take these 12 steps and apply them to your alcoholism, it does wonders for your drug addiction. I don't know that I ever abused drugs. You know, I just, well, one time I did. One time when I was a cocaine dealer, I had an ounce and a half of cocaine that I had ground up, and I had a little white mountain on my counter, and I was weighing out grams. And I had a glass of red wine in a stem glass, and I bumped the counter, and the stem glass fell over, and the wine went right to this little white mountain of cocaine, and it started to turn pink from the counter up, and quick as a flash, I pulled out my wallet, pulled out a credit card, zipped up the everything that was still white on that little hill and saved it. And the rest of the stuff I just sold as Peruvian pink. But I don't know that I've ever opened up a talk at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with a talk about dealing cocaine. I may have, but if I have, it's been a long time. But I don't care. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous speakers. I just love AA speakers. Let me tell you something, too. Jack just announced the speakers that you're going to have at your roundup. I know every one of them, except for Julie, who I don't know, a local speaker, who I assume is just as good as the other ones. But Earl and Rich and Terry are friends of mine, and there's not a single one of them that's right. They're not right at all. they are just not quite right, which is why we like to listen to them. And Susan B. from Oklahoma, your Al-Anon speaker, is just as bad as the alcoholics, only she just didn't drink. I sort of admire the people who get crazy not drinking, but they sort of catch crazy from us, you know, and then they have no excuse. So if you're considering going to the roundup, go and hear all these people. They're great, fun people. Every one of them should have been dead decades ago. They're leading successful lives now. So I just love good AA speakers. I don't know if I'm one. I couldn't care less. I'm the guy tonight, you know. I mean, they've already bought my airplane ticket and put me in a hotel. I mean, what are they going to do? Get a good speaker? You know, so. But I do have fun. Do have fun in sobriety. The fun was not over when I stopped drinking. And as far as drugs, I'll tell you, I have tremendous respect for Alcoholics Anonymous and for the singleness of purpose that's worth defending here. And so if I had known during the time that it was happening where my life was going to go, just out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, the first time somebody said, "Hey man, try this," I would have said, "You know, I'd love to, but I'm going to be speaking at an AA meeting in 30 years, and you know, I don't want to piss off anybody." You know, like. I've become one of those old timers that I used to. Oh, great! There's my car. I told you I set my timer. It may go off again. I don't know. I thought if I didn't bring a laptop, it probably wouldn't interfere with me. But anyway. Was I saying anything important? I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. When I was new, it seemed like an important thing to know. You know, I don't know why. I mean, it's a useless piece of information. There used to be a alcoholic Catholic priest in Alabama named Father Hillary. Some of you may have heard of him, but he was sort of famous for saying, "It don't matter how the jackass got in the ditch, Liam, get him out." That's the deal. I mean, that's what we do here. We get him out. So I don't know. I don't come from an alcoholic family. My family, I'm the oldest of four kids. I'm the only boy. So according to my sisters, I was a little spoiled. My father was an electronics engineer, and my mother worked in the high school cafeteria and later became a Montessori teacher and school owner. And, you know, so, I mean, I'm very privileged in that. I'm the only alcoholic in my immediate family. And so I can find, you know, some credit in being a self-made alcoholic, but for whatever that's worth. But my mother was a den mother. You know what I'm saying? My dad was the scout leader. My wife Carla likes to point out that My dad painted our family pickup truck my high school colors. He was that family, she says. I don't come from an alcoholic family. My dad enjoyed a beer. He would, on a Saturday, he might get a six pack of beer and drink one and then forget that he has beer. Like somebody would come over, "Hey Ed, you got any beer?" Yeah, I think I do. I think I have one in the fridge. And I was 8 years old, like going, "Dad." Remember Saturday you bought six and you drank one? You're a mathematician, right? Like, six minus one, they're right in the fridge. You got to move them to get the lettuce out. But it just wasn't important to him. My sister, who was like exactly 2 years younger than me, had a dinner at her house when I was sober a couple of years. I went over there, and my wife and I went to her house for dinner, and there was five of us for dinner, and she made a pitcher of margaritas, and she knew we didn't drink, so she poured three glasses of margaritas, and then there was some left in the pitcher in the blender, and she threw it right in the sink. And my wife and I both went, "Ah!" And she said, "What? Like, you know, is there a snake in here or something?" I said, "Why did you do that? What? Why did you pour that in the sink?" She said, what do you care? You're not going to drink." And I said, "Yeah." It's not even about drinking. It's about respect, goddammit. But they just don't think about alcohol the same way we do. My wife said, and then they get defensive, right? You know, "Well, maybe I want to use the blender again." My wife said, "It's a $40 item. It wouldn't kill you to have two blenders." My other sister, Yvonne, lived in Wichita. She was a church lady, you know, and I was 5 years sober. I went back to Wichita kind of to make amends. I didn't owe her any money or anything, but I hadn't been a very good brother. I went back to just kind of rekindle our friendship that we had as kids. So I went to church with her, and I got to sing in the choir with her, and we went. She liked to go thrift shopping, and we did that. And so I spent a few days there, and I was going to meetings in the morning in Wichita, so the subject of alcohol came up, and I said, "Yvonne, do you ever?" Because I never saw her take a drink in her life, and I said, "Do you ever drink? I mean, you go out with your friends and have a drink or anything?" And she said, "Well, yeah, I'll have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's." And I couldn't resist, you know. I said, "Every New Year's, you know, they call that pattern drinking." And it's amazing how defensive non-alcoholics will get about their non-drinking, you know. "Well, not every New Year's." I said, "Oh, wow. Really? You skip a year?" She said, "No, I always mean to, but it's New Year's, Doug. There's guns going off outside. The dogs are barking. The kids are making, you know, sometimes I just forget." Wine and forget. I can't imagine designing a sentence to use both those words in the same sentence. And so it's because alcohol is not important to people. When I was new, my first sponsor was going through, we were working on the first step, and he said, "Do you remember a time ever when you just had one drink and stopped?" I do. Yeah. One time, I'm a wood carver, and I had a pair of birds that I had to finish. I had to deliver them in the morning, and my girlfriend and I went out to this Mexican restaurant, and we had a margarita, and then she had a Mexican coffee at the end, and I thought, "I better not do that. I got to stay up all night finishing these birds." So I didn't. And he said, "Oh, okay, when was that?" I said, "That was 1979. And he said, "Okay, Okay. Most people can't even remember the last time they had one drink, unless it was today, you know. And if they do remember, they don't have to go back 9 years. You know? Okay, all right. I get it. But so alcohol is important to me, I guess. Yeah, it is. I wouldn't be here tonight if it wasn't. So I didn't come from an alcoholic family. That's my mother, actually, my mom may have been an alcoholic. We never could tell because she wouldn't drink. And I know it seems obvious, but when I was about 3 years sober, I started thinking, because I'm still thinking, how come I'm an alcoholic? And I said to my mom, "Mom, why don't you drink?" And it just totally caught her off guard. She was like, because I'm sober 3 years. I'm recovering from my disease, you know, and she's recovering from my disease. And she said, "Why don't I drink?" I said, "Yeah, why don't you ever drink?" She said, why are you asking me that?" So now it seems like she's getting defensive. I said, "Well, are you an alcoholic?" She said, "What? Am I an alcoholic?" Look at us, the two of us in this room, nobody else here. Guess which one's the alcoholic? And I said, "No, I mean," she said, "why, have you ever seen me take a drink in your life?" I said, "No, I have not. But I know hundreds of alcoholics that don't drink, so what's your deal?" And she said, and I think maybe I was getting intense for her, you know. And she said, I don't know, when I was young, my friends drank and I drank with them. And every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious. So I just stopped. And I said, you got to drink through that, Mom. You know? I'm preaching to the choir here. But, you know, and I never had a drink. Yeah, I guess because I came from a family where there was really no drinking to speak of. Can I get a glass of water or something? I can talk right now, but I think in a few minutes I'm going to lose it. And I got a lot of really good stuff to say. it entertains me. So I never really was interested in drinking. And the guys that drank in high school, friends of mine that drank, did not make it look attractive, you know. I mean, they got silly and stupid, and there was no attraction there. I wasn't opposed to it. My friend Morris, so here's what happened. My friend Morris, he was kind of like my sexual sponsor. You know, he was a little more advanced than the rest of us that we hung out together. And Morris said to me, we were seniors in high school, he said, "If you want to get a home run with this girl, you're going to have to get her drunk." Yeah. Thank you. That's what he said. If you want to get a home run with it, because we used to use these baseball terms, you know. I don't know if they use those anymore. But we had, when I was in high school, we had a first base and a second base. We got the third base, and then there was the home run. And I don't even remember where the bases are now. You know. I mean, you know, when you're married a long time, it's like step up to the plate and slide home. And there's not enough bases anyway, you know. But there was at the time, and I certainly remember what home run was. And Morris said, "If you want to get a home run with this girl, you're going to have to get her drunk." So I heard that. So guys that I hung out with drank this Rainier Ale. They usually drank quarts of it, and comes from Olympia, Washington, and made from good water, and they somehow do something to it to make it taste like carbonated dishwater. And so so I went and stole a quart of Rainier Ale, and this girl and I went and parked by the railroad tracks. Now, we had parked at this exact railroad track a number of times and did, I don't know what they called, making out or heavy petting or something. And this time I got my ammunition, you know, and I still didn't care about drinking, really, not at all. I would have been happy to say, "Here, drink this and let me know when you're ready." But it just seemed rude, you know, so I popped the top on that bottle and I had a pull and I handed it to her, And she took it, and she had a pull. And I think back on it, she was so ready to drink that ale, we may not even have needed the ale. We may have been there for the same thing. But anyway, we passed this bottle back and forth till we killed it, and we killed it pretty quickly. And I got this warm feeling, this warm, happy, cool feeling. When I say cool, you know, don't you love the word cool? Because it has transcended through the generations, you know. It's the beatniks had cool, you know, and the hippies had cool, and the Gen X has had cool. Everybody's had cool. Is the same thing. Cool is Fonzie, you know what I'm saying? And I knew when I was in high school, I knew what cool looked like. If you were cool, I said, that guy is cool, man. And I even knew how to kind of look cool, you know, how to dress cool, how to walk cool. But I knew I wasn't cool. I wasn't a fool of myself. But I was in that car that night, and I was cool. This is what cool is. Cool is Doug tonight. And she was, too. Cool and sexy, both of us. And so this turned out to be the first time I ever had an alcohol buzz, and the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. So I'm like... We talk about commitments around here, you know. I'm going to do both these things much as I can the rest of my life. So I started drinking, and then, you know, and then it wasn't too long. And then I learned to play guitar, and I was playing folk music at the time. It was like the Kingston Trio, and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Joan Baez, and Pete Seeger, and Bob Dylan, and then you find out about the old guys, the Woody Guthries, and all that. And I was playing in coffee houses. Young people, when I say coffee houses, I'm not talking about Starbucks now. You know, these were like dark places with a stage and dingy lighting, and people played music and told jokes, and that's what I started doing. And then I got in a couple of different bands, and then then the Beatles came to town, and the Beatles sort of changed the structure of music a little bit, and did the whole British invasion, and then San Francisco, so all of this happened, and it was like I got into rock and roll play. I was in a bunch of different bands, and I moved from Orange County, where I grew up to Hollywood, and because I had a friend who lives up there, who was kind of my musical mentor, and he was in a band, and then his roommate was a studio musician. So I moved up there, and I got in a band called The Rock Wall, and we were playing Sunset Boulevard, and that was a good job. You know, you just go in at night, and you play, you work for like 4 or 5 hours playing songs and drinking and using and meeting people. And but what happened was a show came to town. The show I told you about earlier, Hair. It opened on Broadway, and it was a big hit. And they won the Tony that year for the best musical. And then they came out to different places. They came to Chicago, and they came to L.A. And when they opened in L.A., I went to see it. And I just fell in love, because I've always loved musicals anyway. I mean, I really love my rock and roll and country music and the blues. But I, something about musical comedies where, you know, they're on stage and they're couples walking down the street and they fall in love and they touch, and you can almost see the sparks, and, you know, and then the music starts to play, and then they sing to each other in the middle of the street. Then the whole neighborhood comes out and sings and dances with them. You know, this is love, you know, and I think this is... And then they stop, and everybody claps, and the people go home. So that's the way I think life should be. But this was a musical about hippies. It was rock and roll music. It was sex and drugs. And I just fell in love with it. There's a character named Burger. They came out and stripped down to a loincloth, climbed up a scaffold, swung on a rope, and screamed rock and roll and insulted the audience. And I thought, I could do that. And so the next day I called the Aquarius Theater. And I went to see it on a Tuesday. And Wednesday afternoon I called the Aquarius Theater. And the receptionist, Aquarius Theater, may I help you? I said, yeah, I want to be in your show. I promise you this cannot happen today. Today, the receptionist would say something like, well, who is your agent? Can you have your representative contact us? And perhaps, now, 1969 was a different world. She said, just a minute, I'll connect you. She connected me right to the company manager. He said, Dick Osorio, can I help you? I said, yeah, I want to be in your show. Oh, you do, huh? Can you sing and dance? I said, yeah, man, I wouldn't call if I couldn't sing and dance. That's what I do. That's what I do for, that's how I pay my rent, brother. You know, that's how I keep my lights on, man. You know, put gas in my car. Yeah, I can sing and dance. Now, I never danced a step in my life. I'm up on the stage. You're dancing. I'm playing. That's good dancing. Bad dancing. I mean, how hard can it be? So, but I was comfortable with my singing. I thought maybe I'll never have to, you know, dance if they hear how good I sing. So, so he said, what are you doing Friday at 1 o'clock? I said, you tell me. He said, we're having auditions Friday at 1 o'clock. What's your name? I told him, and he said, great. Got my name, my phone number, and he said, bring a piece of sheet music that you like to sing, and we'll I'll give you an audition. So it's like, I wasn't on the phone 10 minutes, and I got an audition in 2 days. So I went right down to Wallach's Music City on Sunset, and I went through all the sheet music, found a song that I like to sing, and I sang it every night. And I took it home, and I practiced it. I went to work, and I sang it twice that night. And then the next day, all day, I'm Thursday, I got my guitar out practicing this song. Friday morning, I got my guitar out, and I'm practicing this song, and I broke a string. And it's... There's no way to explain it. Hippies were like, oh, bad karma, dude. And so I went into my roommate's room to see if he had the D string, and right in the middle of his messed up dresser was a little white envelope, D string. And I'm like, oh, good karma, dude. So I picked it up, and underneath that envelope was a little white capsule. Thought, I wonder what that is. We didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything. And swallow test is a good test. Forget about motor vehicles and heavy machinery. If you eat it, you're going to know precisely what it does, and you can share that with your partners, you know. And then if somebody dies, don't eat the green shit. So this turned out to be THC, synthetic marijuana. Yeah. And so 45 minutes later, when I went down and started up my Harley, and where we lived up in Laurel Canyon was about 4 miles from Sunset Boulevard, where the Aquarius Theater was. So I went out and fired up that Harley and started down Laurel Canyon, and it's pretty, you know. I remember I had my sheet music in my right hand, the throttle hand, and it was going, oh my God, if that thing flies away, I'm out of here. I'm just like, I lost my whole career. And so I got down on Sunset Boulevard. I pulled into the Aquarius lot, and I put the kickstand down, and I remember, seemed like it took me about 3 minutes to swing my leg over. Like, everything is beautiful, you know, and I sort of floated up the stairs at the Aquarius Theater. My hair was real long. It was over my shoulders. Just swished when I walked, you know. And I had these hip-hugger bell bottoms on, big bells like that. They call them elephant bells. I know some of you remember those. And no shirt. I was wearing this vest with 6 layers of foot-long red, white, and blue leather fringe. It's like, woo! Yeah, it was a walking wind chime. And I floated up the stairs at the Aquarius, and I'm standing at the back of the auditorium, and they already started the auditions. And I'm standing back there holding my sheet music and watching these. I'm saying, God damn, these hippies can sing and dance, man. Almost forgot why I was there. And then somebody called my name. Doug Rowell, is Doug Rowell here? Yeah. And I went running down the aisle and up on stage, and I handed the sheet music to the piano player, and he opens it up, big grin, and he starts to play. Bum, 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 bum. I said, ah! I feel good! And I went into this James Brown number. I thought I was the godfather of soul, and I'm down on one knee, and I'm back up, and when I hold you, and I'm just, you know, so good! So good! I got it, you! Bum, 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 bum! Wow! And, and it felt good to me, you know, it got good. And the people who were judging the auditioners were kind of nudging each other. One guy said, We love your energy, man. Can you do something a little mellower just so we kind of get a range of what you can do? And I said, yeah, no problem. So I went into this a cappella version of Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay, and the piano player knew the tune in the same key. Picked it up, and we were right in the pocket. You know, looks like nothing gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I made myself cry. They said, yeah, man, we love you. We just got to see you dance. And by then, I forgot I didn't know how to dance. I said, play, man. The guy started to play, and I started to move, and I'm seeing my hair coming up. I probably initially looked like the offspring of Joe Cocker and Julia Louis Dreyfus, you know, just sort of like. But I'm seeing these trails of my hair and the fringe on this vest. And I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance? I thought so. And so they hired me. Not for the L.A. show. I thought I was auditioning for the Hollywood show. They were having these auditions to fill some spots in the Las Vegas show, which had just opened. So the guy said, come here and talk. And he said, this is Friday afternoon. He said, can you be in Las Vegas next Tuesday? We'd like you to hire. We'd like to hire you, pay you union scale. And I said, yeah, I can do that. I can do that. I started thinking, what do I have to do? And so I said, sure. So I went home. And I found out where I was supposed to report on Tuesday in Las Vegas. I told my roommates, you got to get another roommate. I got a job in doing hair in Las Vegas. And they're like, cool, because people always wanted to live where we live. It was a great place to live. Musicians were always looking for a place. I told my band, you got to get a new bass player. You know, I'll play the weekend, and then I got to go. And they were like, cool. And then we knew people, you know, could fill in like that. I had to find a home for my dog. A little Vietnamese restaurant said they would take him. And the Vietnamese lady said, we love to walk dog. And anyway, so Tuesday morning, I got everything I needed and put it in a duffel bag on my back and strapped it on the bike and fired up that Harley and took off for Las Vegas. Oh, and ate a tab of orange sunshine just so the trip wouldn't get boring. And reported in Las Vegas. I remember pulling up. I had this nasty old tank shifter, ex-police Harley, and it was kind of ugly, but it was fun. And I pulled up to the International Hotel, and I saw the valets going, and I'll park it. So I went in, and I met the people, and it took me about 3 or 4 days to learn the show, to learn the parts and the dances and the songs and the lines and stuff. And so then we did, and they gave me the understudy, one of the lead roles. And then 6 months later, we left Las Vegas and we became the first national tour of Hair and traveled around the United States and Canada for 3.5 years. And they gave me the lead role, Burger, the obnoxious speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. Yeah, it was a stretch, but I could do it. And we play. We opened in Indianapolis and went to Pittsburgh, where Jack saw me, and Cincinnati and Cleveland, and just all over the place, and up into Canada and down into the South, we did play Atlanta. Yeah, we played a big theater in Atlanta, the biggest player we ever played in. It held 8,000 people. And they had some kind of rule where the audience couldn't come on stage and the actors couldn't go in the audience. And it really kind of screwed up our deal, you know, because we would invite the audience up to dance with us at the end of the show. And that's how you meet girls. And And so, yeah, so we, yeah, some, there was an explosion in that theater. I just remembered. It was way up on the balcony. Somebody set off some kind of a bomb up there. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. And I hope when I get old, I don't just like start, Togo, remember when, anyway, hey, you kids, get off my lawn. Anyway, so we toured the United States and Canada for 3.5 years, and I hooked up with a lady in the show, and we had a little girl, was born on the road, then at the end of the show, we went back to L.A. when the show closed, and she started working as a Kelly girl, in temp, you know, office temp work, and went around auditioning for stuff, and I would get call back after call back, going in and then get down to one or two, three people, and then they'd give it to somebody else. So, I mean, that's the way that business goes. But I got tired of that, and also I was going around. I wasn't always working on music and theater. I was had my little girl with me, and we'd go and visit people and smoke dope and ride her around. I put a car seat on the back of my Harley, and you know, I just did everything wrong as a father. Well, I guess I was a fun dad, but took a lot of chances with her. And stayed loaded most of the time. And finally, her mother just said, "Look, I want you to stay in your daughter's life, but I don't want you in mine. You got to go." So I did, and I did stay active in my daughter's life. And I would pick her up after school. She started going to this Montessori school when she was 3, and I would pick her up after school, and I would keep her until till her mom got home from work. And so we had fun together that way. And but the longer I kept drinking and using, the less dependable I was as a father. And one day I was supposed to pick her up at noon on a Saturday, and we were going to spend the weekend together. And I went over. By this time, I would pick her up in a car, and I went over to pick her up, and I was there at noon like I was supposed to be, but I was drunk, and I didn't mean to be. I just was. You know how that is sometimes. And her stepfather, I wasn't there 5 minutes, and he walked me out on the front porch. He said, "Doug, you're drunk. If you're new in here and somebody says, 'Have you been drinking?' they already know the answer. So you can save yourself some debate time." And Stu said, "Doug, you're drunk." And I said, I am, Stu. He said, "Well, I can't let Star get in the car with you." He's right. So I said, "Yep, I'm sorry." I was so sorry. I was so embarrassed. Embarrassed that I got caught, and embarrassed that I actually would pick up my daughter and drive drunk with her on the streets of Los Angeles. You know, it's one thing to be bad enough to do it. It's another thing to be bad enough to do it and get caught at it by somebody who's a responsible parent. He was a responsible parent to my daughter. And I got every bit of that just killed me. Absolutely killed me. And I said, "I was sorry, I was really looking forward to it." He said, "So was she, so were we, but it's not going to happen." And I said, I'm sorry, it won't happen again, Stu." He said, "I hope not. And I want you to understand, Doug, you're welcome in our home anytime, sober. Don't come over here drunk anymore. It's very hard on Star." That's exactly what he said, syllable for syllable. He didn't say, "Don't come over here drunk, you'll embarrass us in front of the neighbors, or you're going to fall in the pool, or you're going to break our furniture." He said, "Don't come over here drunk, it's hard on Star. He's protecting my only child from me." And I was sober enough to understand that that's what he should do. That's what a good parent does. And I was not a victim. And I said, "Okay," and I left, and I got halfway down the street, and I started to cry. Once the tears started to come, I couldn't hold them back. This pain felt like it was getting more intense every second, and that it would never stop getting intense, that kind of pain. And I was crying so hard I couldn't even see to drive. I turned on the windshield wipers. May not surprise you, that didn't do any good at all. And so I pulled out on the main street, and I pulled into this little strip mall, and I pulled into I opened the door, and I put my feet on the pavement and my head in my hands, and I just sobbed like a baby. I just sobbed harder than I've ever sobbed in my life. And I looked up and saw this red neon sign that said liquor. And I got out of the car, and I walked in that liquor store, and I bought a pint of whiskey. came back to the car and I popped the top on that bottle and I just had a pull on it. Then I had another one and the pain started to diminish. Pain started to go away. I wish you could see what I see. This head's nodding around here. Because you understand. That's, if you're new, that's where you are. You're with the people who understand. It's like when Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob went to visit Bob Dodson in the hospital, AA number 3. And Dodson said to him, look, I know why you guys are here. Don't waste your time. People have talked to me about my drinking before. It never does any good. I usually drink on the way home. And you know what they said? They said, we didn't come to talk to you about your drinking. We came to tell you about our drinking. And they did. And when they left, and then they came back the next day, and Dodson's wife was there, and he said, honey, these are the guys I told you about, the ones who understand. We're the only ones who understand that kind of pain and that kind of release from pain. Two swallows of a liquid can diminish that level of pain. And people say, why do you drink? Why don't you? But I was a long way away from my last drink. And I started to hurt myself. I skied off a cliff up at Mammoth, and it wasn't an accident either. I thought I could do it. It was right after the Winter Olympics. Like, you know, when they jump 170 meters or something like that, a 50-foot cliff didn't look difficult to me. And and it was okay. I was airborne, and airborne was all right. You know when those Olympic guys, when they're airborne, they lean way over the front of their skis, they look like a bird. I always thought they did it because it looks cool, because it does look cool. The reason that all of them do that is because if you don't, your skis will go straight up in the air, and then you're heading towards the planet with the skis on top, head on the bottom, and nobody ever recommends that, right, Cameron? Like, Cameron and I were talking about skiing and snowboarding earlier, and so I landed upside down and broke my shoulder, and the ski patrol had to bring me down, and my sister was there. She had to drive my van back down to the, put me in the hospital, and they operated on my shoulder. I'm out of work for 6 weeks. I just got back to work. I'm back to work for, I don't know, a month or so, and somebody had a party, a Friday night party, lasted all night long. In the morning, most of the people were gone, but a few of us were there. And so the woman that owned the house said, somebody take me to the store and get eggs, I'll make breakfast. So I said, my scooter was parked across the driveway anyway, so we went and got on the Harley and started. And just as I fired it up, the sun crested the horizon. You know what? You know that look when the sky is black and all of a sudden it just starts to turn orange and then a blue sky, and you know it's a very sexy look. And the birds, you know, something. Inspiring about it, and sexy, very sexy. And that was before the California had a helmet law, so our hair is flying in the air, and we got that Harley rumble going, and we both had the same thought, you know what we should do? We should make love in the great outdoors. It just seemed like the next right step, except I don't know if anyone in here is familiar with downtown Burbank, but it's not a place with a lot of like great outdoor lovemaking venues. But we found a 4-story parking structure, and we said, okay, there it is. We'll go up there. We had the whole sky. Nobody can see us, but the gate was locked. So we went around to the fire escape, parked the bike, went up the fire escape. That door is locked. From the outside, I know it's a fire escape. It's got to be unlocked from the inside. So I jumped up on the wall with the intention of going over the wall, opening the door, and have the whole top of that parking structure to ourselves. But I made the jump, but the wall was thicker than I thought. I thought it was going to be a lift like this, but it was like this, and I didn't have the upper body strength. Plus, it turned out I had a 0.40 blood alcohol level. How would you know that? Well, because this is the parking structure of St. Joseph's Hospital. So so when I fell off that 4-story building, I landed feet first, and my knees buckled, and I kicked myself in the ass, and broke my pelvis in two places, snapped the heel bone off my right foot and shoved it through my foot like a bowling ball, and just broke all the little bones in my foot. So I didn't walk away from that one. But like I said, it was the parking structure of St. Joseph's Hospital. So Gala was with me, ran into the ER and said, help me, my friend just fell off your parking lot and it broke him. And he's easy to find, you know. So They took me in there, and I was in the hospital for 10 days while they tried to figure out how to put my foot back together. And I had friends coming in and bringing me gifts, you know. And also, if you have your pelvis is broken in two places, anything you move hurts. I don't know how that is, but if you move your thumb, and so my friends would come in and stand around my hospital bed and tell me jokes. So I go, and then they would bring me things. So it had never occurred to me to say to the doctors, look, I know you're giving me Demerol and Percodan for the pain. I'm self-administering cocaine and Irish whiskey. Is that going to be a conflict? But it turned out it didn't kill me, so I got out of there after 10 days, and it took me 6 weeks before I could learn to walk. It took me 5 months before I could walk without a crutch or a cane or something, and during that period, my friend Teddy got sober, and she was fun to drink with. She was one that would call up, hey, what are you doing? I don't know. What are you doing? Let's go get drunk and be somebody. And if you go drinking with Teddy, there's a 40% chance you're going to get arrested or get in a fight, you know. But it's always worth it. It's worth the chance because she's so much fun. But Teddy got sober during that period when I was recuperating. And everybody who loved her said, have you seen Teddy? My God, you know, she turned into a lady, and she did. She turned, within a couple of weeks, she really turned into a lady. And every time you talk to her, though, she'd throw in things into the conversation that don't belong in there, like steps. And big book and sponsor and meetings. And finally I said, look, Ted, I don't know if you're trying to, you know, draft me into your deal or what, but I'll tell you this, if I ever see alcohol interfering with my life, I probably will go to AA. And that's the reaction she had. She's like, you know that RCA, that old RCA Dalmatian thing of that dog with his master's voice? She said, if you ever see alcohol interfering with your life, Jesus, Doug, what would you call interference? Brain death? And I said, I see where you're going with this. But I don't think accidents should count. You know, I mean, anybody fall off a four-story building is going to get hurt. Drunk or sober, you're getting alcoholism mixed up with gravity, honey. And she's like, okay, whatever. And she left. But all that week, every time I'd have a little quiet moment, I'd picture Teddy's face saying, what would you call interference, Doug? Brain death? And I started thinking, brain death is on the table. I'm just lucky for the way that I fell on the two accidents I told you about. Three other ones that I didn't tell you about could have easily ended in brain death, and the next one very well may. I have no control over that. I have no control over it. It scared me. Today, right now, today, I can hardly think of anything scarier than having to spend the rest of my life in a bed or a wheelchair, unable to feed myself or go to the bathroom by myself, and know it. That scared me so bad, I rushed right down to AA 3 years later. So you want to think about it. You know, I am compulsive about some things, but recovering, not so much. So I went to my first meeting to see what AA was. I went there. I got there earlier. I got there about 6:30, 6:45 for an 8 o'clock meeting, and I walked in there, and they were setting up chairs and laughing and hugging, and I said, where's the alcoholics, you know? And I just leaned against the wall, and watched them. They're sitting up making coffee, and setting up literature and hanging signs, and I can't believe it. You know, there's a subterranean community room at this local hospital. And people would come up to me and say, hey, you're new. And I'd say, no, I'm not. Beat it. And most of them would walk away, except this one guy, Hank, came up and he goes, you're new, right? And I said, wrong. Yeah, I'm not. So he goes, oh, really? I haven't seen you here before. What's your name? He said, my name is Doug, and you haven't seen me here before because I've never been here before. So mystery solved. Take a hike. He goes, well, that's what we mean by new, man. You've never been here before. That's new to us, right? Okay. All right. I'll go along with that. I'm new like I've never been here before, but I'm not new like a new member. Okay. I'm an observer. I'm checking it out, man. That's what I'm doing here. I just can't. I'm auditing the class. You know what I'm saying? I'm just looking to see what's going on here, man. I didn't come here to join up. I don't know what it looks like out there, but I'm not in here going, help me, help me. I'm drowning in a sea of alcohol. I'm not a joiner, man. I just never have been. I'm a loner. I'm an outlaw, okay? Desperado, man. You know what I'm talking about? I'm a misfit. I never fit any place in my life. I didn't fit in school. I don't really fit in the workplace. I barely fit in my own damn family, so I don't think I'm going to fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous, for Christ's sake. Hug, hug, laugh, laugh. Isn't it good we're not drinking? Yeah, that sounds great, man. I'm sorry, man. I don't think I'm your target market, pal. And he goes, man, I like you. You're going to fit right in. And, I wish I'd had some of the AA phrases that you hear now. Take the cotton out of your ears and stuff it in your mouth, you know, or something. I was just like, this guy's not listening to me. I thought I was fairly articulate about how I was not going to fit in. But, of course, he was right. And turns out I fit in very well. But most of us don't come here looking. We look for ways not to fit in. Another guy came in, and I'm standing at the back of the room leaning against the wall while other people are doing stuff and greeting and laughing. And this other guy came in. He walks the other way and leans against the wall on the other side of the double doors. And he looks like almost like a mirror, man. And I thought, well, we're the cool section here, you know. We're too cool to talk. We don't even talk to each other. That's how cool we were. We're like, you know. So me and him are standing at the back, and some people come up. There's some seats. The meeting's about to start. There's some seats up here if you want to sit down. I said, you know what? I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay for your whole deal. So I don't want to go up there and sit. I see. I've been watching. People come in. They put down a jacket, put down a purse, put down keys, no purse, no jacket. That seat's available. I get it. I'm a figure outer. But I may not be able to stay for your whole deal. So if I have to leave, I don't want to, pardon me, excuse me. I'm okay standing at the back. I'm good with that. And I was thinking, a couple of years ago, somebody said, did you have a cell phone? No, I didn't. Because now today, if somebody said, I may not be able to stay for your whole meeting, you'd figure they're going to get a call or a text or something. Nobody had cell phones in 1986. You know, they had mobile phones, but they were big. They were in briefcases and expensive. They were very expensive. Surgeons had them. Producers had them. I didn't have one. I didn't even have a pager. Some people had pagers. Nobody wanted to contact me. What the hell I need a pager for? But what I had was a garage door opener with a belt clip on it. So it looks cool, but it'll never ever bother you. And it's helpful too. Sometimes if you're in a conversation, you want to go get a drink, you can just go, I got to get this. I'll be right back. And it's great unless somebody says, what is that? It looks like my garage door opener. Then you got to think fast. Yeah, well, it is. It's a combination. Garage door opener, pager, and TV remote. It's like the latest, coolest thing. I got one. So then they started the meeting, and people read stuff, and then they had a speaker that night. I stood up through the whole meeting. The funny thing is, the things I remember about, I remember this guy Hank that came up and talked to me and said I was going to fit in. I remember that they had three different kinds of coffee. I don't know why I remember that. I remember they had a birthday. And I don't know if they call them birthdays or anniversaries in Atlanta, but in California they call them birthdays, and everything's about showbiz there, you know. So it's like, oh, we have cakes and everybody sings, and, you know, and so, the secretary said, we have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. And everybody's like, yay, Ruth. And I thought, well, that's cool. They celebrate people's birthdays. So I'm looking around looking for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny honey, right? It's one of those meetings where they have a stage and you have to walk up steps to get to the stage. And Ruth is walking towards the stage. It has to be Ruth. She's the only one walking. And Ruth is 50 if she's a day. And my first thought was, damn, if she's 18, she should stop drinking tonight. But she didn't look bad. She didn't look beat up, you know, like she just crawled out of the gutter. I mean, she was made up and dressed up and coiffed, you know what I mean? She was celebrating her 18 years tonight. And so she got up on stage and these three girls came out holding this cake and with all these candles blazing. And I thought, well, happy birthday, Ruth. I get it. Okay, this is AA. They don't drink. Ruth hadn't had a drink in 18 years. That must be the deal here. Maybe it's a national record. You know, I don't know. Happy birthday, Ruth. And it seemed like I cued the choir. When I thought happy birthday, Ruth, every 200 people started singing, happy birthday to you. 200 people singing happy birthday in four different keys at the same time. I'm not talking about contrapuntal harmonies. No, no. I'm talking about very bad singing. And many of these people were not even committed to the key they started in. And they had a piano on stage, and nobody's playing it. And I thought, I believe to this day, any 200 Americans, somebody can fake happy birthday on the piano. I'm a guitar player, and I could do a G, C, D. It's just not difficult. And I thought, maybe I should go up there, you know, get them all in the same key. Hold it, folks. Here I come to save the day, you know, and get everybody in the same key. And then thought, you know, let's not do that. Every time I step into that little hero suit, it turns out not to be a good idea. Why don't you just shut up? It's a short song. Okay. So happy birthday. Keep coming back. And Ruth says, my name is Ruth and I'm an alcoholic. And of course everybody goes, hi, Ruth! My friend Scott used to say, this is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And some people go, whoa, you know, some people go, oh yeah, she does. And I'm in the back going, God damn, you're a little slow, ain't you, Ruth? You know, I don't know how long it's going to take me to get this thing if I want it, but I do know it's not going to take every day for 18 years. I'm sure of that. And I looked over at the other cool guy to see if he's giggling at this. He's a member. I don't know why he's standing at the back with me. Maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something, but he's heading over to me. And he's got his hand out like we do, you know, and that sunbeam for Jesus smiled. And he takes my hand in both hands and he says, hey, I'll tell you what. Stay sober a year, man. We'll give you one of them cakes. That's what he said. He said, if I don't drink alcohol for 1 year... 12 months, 52 weeks, 365 days, I get a cake. And I was so shocked I couldn't even make fun of him. I'm not much of a pastry eater, really. If I wanted a cake, I'd, you know, just stop at Gelson's on the way home. I think they're like $5 or I could not drink for a year. But then maybe the most important thing that happened at that meeting happened towards the end of it. The secretary said, this is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the basic text of our program, the only authority on AA. She said, if you're new tonight, please don't leave without this book. We sell it at our cost. And I thought, not to me, honey. I'm stealing that book. I'm stealing the book. They had a lot of them on a table with some other literature. I had an idea I could go over and pick up that book, start open it, start to read it, walk right out the door going, this is great. This is going to help. This is really neat. And people, if they even noticed, they'd say, let them go. Oh, man, I can hardly wait to try it. Because, the worst that could happen is, where are you going with that book? Oh, take it. I don't care about your book. But that's the worst that could happen. But I think I can walk out of here with this book. And then she screwed it up. She said, if you're new tonight and you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have this book. We'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week till you get back on your feet. I don't know if I qualify as on my feet, but I'm not homeless. And I don't want you to think I'm homeless by stealing your damn book, so now I got to buy the book. Because I have my pride. I have my pride. I mean, I'll steal from you, but I won't accept your goddamn charity. So now I got to stay to the end of the meeting, and I go up to her, say, excuse me, ma'am, can I buy one of your books? She said, oh, the big book, she said. Yeah. Yeah, the big book. Yeah, I've seen bigger. How much is that big book? She said, it's $4.65. Do you have it? I figured it'd be like $20-$25. It's a hardcover book. $4.65? Yeah, here's a $5. Keep the change. She said, no, I'll get your change. No, ma'am, listen to me. I want you to keep the change and use that change to help a drunk, because I'm on my feet, okay? So now I got my book, and on the way home I stopped and got a fifth of whiskey. I get home with my Bushmills and my book, and I poured about 3 fingers of whiskey, and I sat down to read this book. And I didn't stay up all night studying the big book. That's not who I am or what I need to do, because actually I have this ability to look at the title of a chapter, almost any book, and you're getting ahead of me, aren't you? You got that. You got this thing. Look at the title of a chapter, almost any book, and pretty much know everything in the chapter. It's just a gift that I have, and some of us have. So the doctor's opinion, I didn't bother with that. I've had doctor's opinions. Chapter 1, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter 2, there's a solution. That's a sales pitch. Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. And I was like, okay, great. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And I thought, this actually could be the most boring piece of literature in the English language. So I'm already up to chapter 4. I haven't been reading 3 minutes, and I'm already up to chapter 4, We Agnostics. I did not expect to find a chapter called We Agnostics. I was a little upset, irritated, and hostile towards Alcoholics Anonymous because I never knew that there was a God thing going on in here. A lot of us come in here, oh, no God, oh, don't do the God thing. No, I don't want anything to do with God. And so just the word God throws us off. I was in another tangent. I was at a meeting, a men's meeting on a Saturday morning in Lake Charles, Louisiana one time. And I loved that meeting. And about a third of the people in that area talk with that beautiful Cajun dialect that you don't really hear any place other than South Louisiana. So I was hearing the language of the heart in this Cajun dialect. And one of the old guys in the meeting was standing back there, leaned against the wall, and they called on him. He said, Boudreau, you want to share? Yeah, my name is Boudreau. I'm an alcoholic. Boy, you boys scared me today. I got to say that because, you know, everybody had been talking about God, and we got new people in here today. And I tell you, when I was new and I come in here, everybody be talking about God, well, I would be right out the door. And it was quiet for a minute. And then one of the new guys said, where would you go? Where would you go? Have anybody, let me see a show of hands. Anybody ever been any place to hear somebody say, AA sent me here, you know? That doesn't happen. People get sent here. So anyway, so I wasn't happy about this God thing. I came in here and I was like, everybody's talking about God. But now they got this chapter called We Agnostics, and I thought, this is it. This is how the smart people stay sober without God. So I poured another 3 fingers of whiskey and I read chapter 4 all the way through. I got to the end and I thought, I have absolutely no idea what I just read. Because I'm looking for how the smart people stay sober without God, and the information is not in that chapter. If anything, it's the opposite. It should be called How We Agnostics Came to Believe in a Power Greater Than Ourselves, which saved us from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, but it's not in there. So what happened was, I read it again. I poured another 3 fingers of whiskey and I read it again. Something jumped off the page at me. There's a little sentence in there that says, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. I thought I knew something about religions of the world, Western and Eastern. Never, not any kind of an expert, but somewhat knowledgeable. And I never heard anybody say, we don't think God makes hard terms. My grandmother was a Pentecostal minister. She was also a drunk who got sober when she found Jesus. And she spent the last 37 years of her life doing what we do. Trust God, clean house, help others. That's what she did with her life. And she stayed sober 37 years. But she hated AA. And I always thought because there was no God here. When I found out there was a God here, I realized it's not the same brand of God that she thought was necessary. I'll tell you, this is another side story. My grandmother told me on her deathbed, she took my hand, she said, Doug, I was about 3 or 4 years sober. Doug, I know you're doing God's work. So she got a vision of it. I was the only big book that she saw. But I would go down to her church, her Four Square Gospel Church, and they would say, well, hello, Doug. I hope you brought your guitar. Doug, they call me Doug. But they never said, we don't think God makes hard terms. They say, you know, Doug, we are very sure that God makes hard times on those who seek Him. Boy, you know, God will not even hear your prayers unless you're baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist. No, I'm talking about total submission, boy. Total submission. That's why we got a tank of water for Christ up here. Come on up, boy. Come on up. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Amen. Somebody get the boy a towel. You know, and I'm like 14. I thought, I am not getting wet in this room. I don't know. You know, my grandmother was a little bitty thing, but she wouldn't let him drown her only grandson. But, you know, they're big guys, and maybe she told them I touched myself, you know. I mean, I can hear Brother Van Dyke in my mind saying, I'm going to miss that boy's guitar playing, but thank God he don't have to abuse himself no more. And so I told him, you know, I got shrink to fit Levi's on. They're shrink to fit. I couldn't even ride my bicycle. I'll be back. I'm out of there. But it wasn't just the Pentecostals. My girlfriend was Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons, to determine how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers would cleanse her soul of the various sins, you know, because they got levels of sins, venial, menial, cardinal, mortal. Some of them you don't even have to do them. If you think about them, expressway to hell, partner. That's not my deal. My friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew, and he and his brother Sherm had to wear spit curls to school. So there's a loving God for you. You know, went over to Michael's house for dinner one night, and his mom says, Doug, welcome to our home. It's an honor to have you. Would you like to join us in some wine and challah? Some what? Would you like to join the family in some wine and challah? I said, well, I'll have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater, Mrs. Steinem. And then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. But I never heard anything like, we don't think God makes hard terms on those who seek Him. Preceded by another sentence that says, you don't have to accept anyone's concept of God. If you find one that you're comfortable with, the Creator seems to be comfortable with that. That's a paraphrase. I sometimes paraphrase the big book. I have sections memorized, or act like I do. And my friend Howard P. used to say, I'll give you page numbers. They may not be the right ones, but it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. But if anybody catches me misquoting the book, give me a call, 818-353-4607. And talk to me. Sometimes people listen. I just listened to your CD. I'm driving across the country, and did I say something wrong? No, I just want to see if it's really your number. 818-353-4607. Anyway, so this got my attention. I went back to AA. My first 8 months in AA, I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment anywhere. I didn't believe in God. And I was drinking every day. And except for that, I had a pretty good program. But, but my whole deal was keep coming back. And I did that for 8 months. And I started taking bogus chips. I got tired of raising my hand as new. And one day I didn't raise my hand, and some girl who was on my 13-step wish list said to her friend, Doug's got 30 days, and so I took a 30-day chip, and everybody loved it so much, I started taking 30-day chips, and then I went to a meeting. I heard a girl say to her friend, "My sponsor says I can't have sex till I'm sober 6 months," so I took a 6-month chip over that. I had 4 different sobriety dates at 4 different groups. I'm not recommending this. The main reason, I mean, it's funny, the story to tell, but the main reason I'm saying it, because sometimes there are people in meetings that are doing that, and if you are, don't give up. Don't go home and say, you know, I'm a liar and a thief and a cheat, and I'm just, people are trying to save my life and I'm lying to them. Keep coming back. That's the only thing I did right for 8 months. And today I'm sober 30, in a couple of weeks I'll be, in 3 weeks I'll be sober 32 years. And, it's funny, we applaud when people tell us how long it be since I haven't drank, you know, like somebody running out of a burning building. Yeah, what a hero, you know. But eventually, what happened to me, I came home from a meeting one night, and I had a bottle of whiskey, and it was about 10:30 at night. I laid on the floor and opened that bottle and drank whiskey and watched TV till I passed out. That's what I usually did. And I woke up about 3 a.m., I got my, turned off the TV and I got my bottle and I crawled on my hands and knees through the living room, through the hallway into the bedroom to go to bed. And I stood up to get undressed and I fell. Just fell on my knees and I spilled this whiskey all over the bed and I grabbed the bottle real quick. Most of it was in the bedspread, but some of it was still in the bottle. Set the bottle in a safe place and I grabbed the bedspread, started sucking whiskey out of the bedspread because that's where the whiskey was. And, you know, a voice in my head said, "Hey, man, that ain't right." You thirsty? There's whiskey in the bottle, man. I'm like, not thirsty. I'm frugal. You know, I'll waste my life, but I'm not letting whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight. I looked at what I'm doing. Yeah, there's whiskey in the bottle. I'm done drinking, and here I am. I've been going to AA for 8 months, and I haven't learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. Maybe the evidence says that I'm one of those losers who can't get this thing. I can't believe that. I don't believe it, but the evidence all points to that. And I was lost and alone and scared, and I did a dumb thing. I said, "God, if you're there, please help me." And I absolutely meant it. It was a sincere prayer of desperation. And I don't believe that I even for a second thought anybody was listening to it. I just was out of ideas. But the next, and I went to bed and I went to sleep. And over the next couple of weeks, the next day I went into my neighborhood liquor store. This somebody from AA behind the counter of my liquor store. I said, "What are you doing here?" "No," he said, "What are you doing here?" "I just came to get some cigarettes." And I got my cigarettes and I went someplace else and got a bottle. And I was in a restaurant and the waitress is somebody I know from AA. "Hey, got any grapefruit juice?" And I was in the Vaughn's Market in the liquor department, reached up for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. "Hey, one day at a time, keep it simple." And because like I said, I got 4 different sobriety dates at 4 different groups. I'm lying to everybody. My family, my friends, my drinking buddies, I'm lying to. You know, I'm barely honest with myself. But every day, somebody from AA is between me and a drink. And it didn't keep me from drinking. But after 14 days of this, literally 2 weeks, I'm on the way to work at 6:30 in the morning. I just killed a half pint of Bushmills. I don't keep empty bottles in the car. They're illegal, you know. And so I roll down the window and toss a bottle. Just as a guy from AA is driving towards me, saw me and waved, and I threw a bottle in front of his car. Bing-a-ling, bang-dang. And I thought, oh, my God, where are these people coming from? You know, like, it's like these people from AA, you know.
"Really, have we seen a person fail?"
And I remember that I'd been on my knees and said, "God, if you're there, please help me." And I clearly had gotten the help that I asked for. And maybe that's not the first time that ever happened, but it's the first time I ever noticed if it was. And I pulled the car over the side of the road and I sat there and it seemed like I could hear God laughing. Yeah. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I've been sober, as I said, almost 32 years. since then. Been active in AA every day of my sobriety in one way or another. I've had 8 sponsors. Half of them died and half of them just moved on. I've been happily and faithfully married for 21 years to 3 of the finest women in AA. Took me a while to get to the right one, you know. Nothing wrong with the first two, but my wife, Carla, some of you have heard her speak. She was here last year. And but we have this beautiful, beautiful, sober life. My daughter, by the way, told me a couple of years ago, she said, you know, I always thought of you as the fun parent. And I look back and I see you're the one who's always there for me. And I thought, absolutely not true. I told you the story of the one time that I disappointed her, but that happened over and over and over again when I was drinking. But I've been sober long enough and there for her long enough that it appears I got sober when she was 15. And it seems like I'm the one who's always been there for her. And you can't buy that. There's no way. It takes time to put that together. And I usually don't tell this, but I want to tell you, my friend Teddy, that I used to love to drink with, and she got sober. And I don't know that I would be sober today if it weren't for Teddy. She never was my official sponsor, but she was my sponsor, not of record. You know, she was the one that I knew had a good program that I would call when I had questions and things. And she married a handsome TV star, and they had a little girl. And the little girl grew up and went to college. And she just had this storybook life. And she had some back surgery a few years ago when she was 25 years sober, and she had to take pain pills. But she let them get a little out of hand, and she started getting prescriptions from different doctors. And then by the time she realized that her drug addiction was out of hand and she had to restart her sobriety date, she didn't want to do it, and it made her so mad. She said, if I got to start my date over again, I'm going to get a bottle of Jack. And so she did. And then she got sober. She told her sponsor, and she got another sponsor, and then she got active again, and then she went out again, and she's gone out back and forth, and she'd have months of sobriety. And then 2 years ago, her daughter found her dead. Her daughter called me and said, Doug, my mom, Teddy, and I said, yeah, how are you? She said, no, she's dead. She died. I found her in her bed this morning. And I wanted to call you and ask you if you would sing at her funeral. So, there was a song that I wrote called Journey. Sometimes this journey seems to have a mind of its own. Like a small child's boat, we're just drifting along in the current. And I won't do the whole thing, but I sang that song at Teddy's memorial. And she was at one point the best version of the Big Book that was available to me. And it's just like my friend Clint Hodges used to say. I told him one time, he said he didn't get it till he was 22 years sober. I told him, I have a tape of you speaking when you were 18 years sober, and that's not the talk of somebody who didn't get it. And he said, okay, maybe it's not so much that I didn't get it, it's that you have to keep getting it. That's what this is. That's why I'm here today. That's why I go to a meeting every single day. My home group is a 7 a.m. meeting. Meets every day of the year at 7 a.m. in Studio City, called Winner's Attitude Adjustment Group. And I have to stay connected there, lest I get away and start thinking that I can stay sober with AA, without AA, or start thinking maybe I'm not an alcoholic, or just thinking one beer is not going to hurt me. What can a glass of wine do? A little sacramental wine, a little toast to the bride, a little... Carla says, I don't use alcohol or anything, not in my mouthwash, not in my food. She says, I don't know who puts food in their alcohol anyway, but but she says a good thing. Carla says, I will never be so spiritual that I can take a drink of alcohol. If you're new in here, please stick around. Please stick around and give this thing a shot. Don't go back to the bar and say, I tried AA and it didn't work. If you haven't taken the step, you haven't gotten a sponsor, taken the steps, and got active in Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't know if it works or not. So I challenge you to do all the stuff. Do all the stupid, idiotic things your sponsor tells you to do, even if it's just to prove that it won't work. See what happens. if you don't drink for a year, we'll give you a cake.